Welcome to Bookmarked, where you can take a pause and dive into the wide world of literature. I am Ms. Kaiser, sponsor of the BHS podcast team, and today I am going to read the first chapter of The Kiss of Deception, part of the Remnant Chronicles by Mary E. Pearson, as part of our First Chapter Friday series. Chapter 1. Today was the day a thousand dreams would die and a single dream would be born. The wind knew. It was the 1st of June, but cold gusts bit at the hilltop citadel as fiercely as deep as winter, shaking the windows with curses and winding through drafty halls with warning whispers. There was no escaping what was to come. For good or bad, the hours were closing in. I closed my eyes against the thought, knowing that soon the day would cleave in two, forever creating the before and after of my life. And it would happen in one swift act that I could no more alter than the color of my eyes. I pushed away from the window, fogged with my own breath, and left the endless hills of Morgan to their own worries. It was time for me to meet my day. The prescribed liturgies passed as they were ordained, the rituals and rites as each had been precisely laid out, all a testament to the greatness of Morgan and the remnant from which it was born. I didn't protest. By this point, numbness had overtaken me. But then midday approached, and my heart galloped again as I faced the last of the steps that kept here from there. I lay naked, face down on a stone-hard table, my eyes focused on the floor beneath me while strangers scraped my back with dull knives. I remained perfectly still, even though I knew the knives brushing my skin were held with cautious hands. The bearers were well aware that their lives depended on their skill. Perfect stillness helped me hide the humiliation of my nakedness as strange hands touched me. Pauline sat nearby watching, probably with worried eyes. I couldn't see her, only the slate floor beneath me, my long dark hair tumbling down around my face in a swirling black tunnel that blocked the world out except for the rhythmic rasp of the blades. The last knife reached lower, scraping the tender hollow of my back, just above my buttocks, and I fought the instinct to pull away, but I finally flinched. A collective gasp spread through the room. "Be still," my Aunt Cloris admonished. I felt my mother's hand on my head, gently caressing my hair. "A few more lines, Arabella, that's all." Even though this was offered as comfort, I bristled at the formal name my mother insisted on using, the hand-me-down name that had belonged to so many before me. I wished that at least on this day, in Morgan, she'd cast formality aside and used the one I favored, the pet name my brothers used, shortening one of my many names to its last three letters, Leah, a simple name that felt truer to who I was. The scraping ended. "It is finished," the first artisan declared. The other artisans murmured their agreement. I heard the clatter of a tray being set on the table next to me and whiffed the overpowering scent of rose oil. Feet shuffled around to form a circle. My aunts, mother, Pauline, others who'd been summoned to witness the task, and mumbled prayers were sung. I watched the black robe of the priest brush past me, and his voice rose above the others as he drizzled the hot oil on my back. The artisans rubbed it in, their practiced fingers sealing in the countless traditions of the House of Morgan, deepening the promises written upon my back, heralding the commitments of today and ensuring all their tomorrows. They can hope, I thought bitterly, as my mind jumped out of turn, trying to keep order to the tasks still before me, the ones written only on my heart and not a piece of paper. I barely heard the utterance of the priest, a droning chant that spoke to all of their needs and none of my own. I was only 17. Wasn't I entitled to my own dreams for the future? "And for Arabella, Celestine, Idris, Jazelia, first daughter of the House of Morrigan, the fruits of her sacrifice and the blessings of..." He prattled on and on, the endless required blessings and sacraments, his voice rising, filling the room. And then, when I thought I could stand no more, his very words pinching off my airways, he stopped, and for a merciful sweet moment silence rang in my ears. I breathed again, and then the final benediction was given. "For the kingdoms rose out of the ashes of men and are built on the bones of the lost, and thereunto we shall return if heaven wills." He lifted my chin with one hand, and with the thumb of his other hand, he smudged my forehead with ashes. "So shall it be for this first daughter of the House of Morrigan," my mother finished, as was the tradition, and she wiped the ashes away with an oil-dipped cloth. I closed my eyes and lowered my head. First daughter, both blessing and curse, and if the truth be known, a sham. My mother laid her hand on me again, her palm resting on my shoulder. My skin stung at her touch. Her comfort came too late. The priest offered one last prayer in my mother's native tongue, a prayer of safekeeping that oddly wasn't tradition, and then she drew her hand away. More oil was poured, and a low, haunting sing-song of prayers echoed through the cold stone chamber, the rose scent heavy in the air and in my lungs. I breathed deeply. In spite of myself, I relished this part, the hot oils and warm hands kneading compliance into knots that had been growing inside me for weeks. The velvet warmth soothed the sting of acid from the lemon mixed with dye, and the flowery fragrance momentarily swept me away to a hidden summer garden where no one could find me. If only it were that easy. Again, this step was declared finished, and the artisans stepped back from their handiwork. There was an audible gathering of breath as the final results on my back were viewed. I heard someone shuffle closer. I dare say he won't be looking long upon her back with the rest of that view at his disposal. A titter ran through the room. Aunt Burnett was never one to restrain her words, even with a priest in the room and protocol at stake. My father claimed I got my impulsive tongue from her, though today I'd been warned to control it. Pauline took my arm and helped me to rise. "Your Highness," she said as she handed me a soft sheet to wrap around myself, sparing what little dignity I had left. We exchanged a quick knowing glance, which bolstered me, and then she guided me to the full-length mirror, giving me a small silver hand mirror that I might view the results too. I swept my long hair aside and let the sheet fall enough to expose my lower back. The others waited in silence for my response. I resisted drawing in a breath. I wouldn't give my mother that satisfaction, but I couldn't deny that my wedding kavah was exquisite. It did indeed leave me in awe. The ugly crest of the kingdom of Dalbrook had been made startlingly beautiful, the snarling lion tamed on my back, the intricate designs gracefully hemming in his claws, the swirling vines of Morrigan weaving in and out with nimble elegance, spilling in a V down my back, until the last delicate tendrils clung and swirled in the gentle hollow of my lower spine. The lion was honored and yet cleverly subdued. My throat tightened and my eyes stung. It was a kavah I might have loved, might have been proud to wear. I swallowed and imagined the prince when the vows were complete, and the wedding cloak lowered, gaping with awe, the lecherous toad. But I gave the artisans their due. It is perfection, I thank you, and I have no doubt the kingdom of Dalbrook will from this day forward hold the artisans of Morrigan in highest esteem. My mother smiled at my effort, knowing that these few words for me were hard won. And with that, everyone was ushered away, the remaining preparations to be shared only with my parents and Pauline, who would assist me. My mother brought me the white silk underdress from the wardrobe, a mere wisp of fabric so thin and fluid it melted across her arms. To me, it was a useless formality, for it covered very little, being as transparent and helpful as the endless layers of tradition. The gown came next, the back plunging in the same V so as to frame the kavah, honoring the prince's kingdom and displaying his bride's new allegiance. My mother tightened the laces in the hidden structure of the dress, pulling it snug so the bodice appeared to effortlessly cling to my waist even without fabric stretching across my back. It was an engineering feat as remarkable as the Great Bridge of Golgotha, maybe more so, and I wondered if the seamstress had cast a bit of magic into the fabric and threads. It was better to think on these details than the short hour would bring. My mother turned me ceremoniously to face the mirror. Despite my resentment, I was hypnotized. It was truly the most beautiful gown I had ever seen. Stunningly elegant, the dense croisé lace of local lace makers was the only adornment around the dipping neckline. Simplicity. The lace flowed in a V down the bodice to mirror the cut of the back of the dress. I looked like someone else in it, someone older and wiser, someone with a pure heart that held no secrets. Someone not like me. I walked away without comment and stared out the window, my mother's soft sigh following on my heels. In the far distance, I saw the lone red spire of Golgotha, its single crumbling ruin all that remained of the once massive bridge that spanned the vast inlet. Soon it would be gone, swallowed up like the rest of the great bridge. Even the mysterious engineering magic of the ancients couldn't defy the inevitable. Why should I try? My stomach lurched, and I shifted my gaze closer to the bottom of the hill, where wagons lumbered on the road far below the citadel, heading toward the town square, perhaps laden with fruit or flowers or kegs of wine from the Morrigan vineyards. Fine carriages pulled by matching ribboned steeds dotted the lane as well. Maybe in one of those carriages, my oldest brother, Walter, and his young bride, Greta, sat with fingers entwined on their way to my wedding, scarcely able to break their gazes from each other, and maybe my other brothers were already at the square, flashing their smiles at young girls who drew their fancy. I remembered seeing Regan, dreamy-eyed and whispering to the coachman's daughter just a few days ago, in a dark hallway, and Bryn dallied with a new girl each week, unable to settle on just one. Three older brothers I adored, all free to fall in love and marry anyone they chose. The girls free to choose as well. Everyone free, including Pauline, who had a beau who would return to her at month's end. "How did you do it, Mother?" I asked, still staring at the passing carriages below. "How did you travel all the way from Gastineau to marry a toad you didn't love?" "Your father is not a toad," my mother said sternly. I whirled to face her. "A king, maybe, but a toad nonetheless. Do you mean to tell me that when you married a stranger twice your age, you didn't think him a toad?" My mother's gray eyes rested calmly on me. "No, I did not, and it was my destiny and my duty." A weary sigh broke from my chest. "Because you were a first daughter." The subject of first daughter was one my mother always cleverly steered away from. Today, with only the two of us present and no other distractions, she couldn't turn away. I watched her stiffen, her chin rising in good royal form. "It's an honor, Arabella." "But I don't have the gift of first daughter. I'm not a Ciara. Dalbrook will soon discover I'm not the asset they suppose me to be. This wedding is a sham." "The gift may come in time," she answered weakly. I didn't argue this point. It was known that most first daughters came into their gift by womanhood, and I had been a woman for 4 years now. I'd shown no signs of any gift. My mother clung to false hopes. I turned away, looking out the window again. "Even if it doesn't come," my mother continued, "the wedding is no sham. This union is about far more than just one asset. The honor and privilege of a first daughter in a royal bloodline is a gift in itself. It carries history and tradition with it. That's all that matters." "Why first daughter? Can you be sure the gift isn't passed to a son or a second daughter?" "It's happened, but not to be expected, and not tradition." "And is it tradition to lose your gift too?" Those unsaid words hung razor sharp between us, but even I couldn't wound my mother with them. My father hadn't consulted with her on matters of state since early in their marriage, but I had heard the stories of before, when her gift was strong and what she said mattered. That is, if any of it was even true. I wasn't sure anymore. I had little patience for such gibberish. I liked my words and reasoning simple and straightforward, and I was so tired of hearing about tradition that I was certain if the word were spoken aloud one more time, my head would explode. My mother was from another time. I heard her approach and felt her warm arms circle about me. My throat swelled. "My precious daughter," she whispered against my ear, "whether the gift comes or doesn't come is of little matter. Don't worry yourself so. It's your wedding day." To a toad. I had caught a glimpse of the king of Dalbrook when he came to draw upon the agreement, as if I were a horse given in trade to his son. The king was as decrepit and crooked as an old crone's arthritic toe, old enough to be my own father's father, hunched and slow. He needed assistance up the steps to the grand hall. Even if the prince was a fraction of his age, he'd still be a withered, toothless fop. The thought of him touching me, much less, I shivered at the thought of bony old hands caressing my cheek or shriveled sour lips meeting mine. I kept my gaze fixed out the window, but saw nothing beyond the glass. Why could I not have at least inspected him first? My mother's arms dropped from around me. "Inspect a prince. Our relationship with Dalbrook is already tenuous at best. You'd have us insult their kingdom with such a request when Morrigan is hoping to create a crucial alliance." "I'm not a soldier in father's army." My mother drew closer, brushing my cheek, and whispered, "Yes, my dear, you are." A chill danced down my spine. She gave me a last squeeze and stepped back. "It's time. I'll go retrieve the wedding cloak from the vault," she said, and left. I crossed the room to my wardrobe and flung open the doors, sliding out the bottom drawer and lifting a green velvet pouch that held a slim jeweled dagger. It had been a gift on my 16th birthday from my brothers, a gift I was never allowed to use, at least openly. But the back of my dressing chamber door bore the gouged marks of my secret practice. I snatched a few more belongings, wrapping them in a chemise, and tied it all with ribbon to secure it. Pauline returned from dressing herself, and I handed her the small bundle. "I'll take care of it," she said, a jumble of nerves at the last-minute preparations. She left the chamber just as my mother returned with the cloak. "Take care of what?" my mother asked. I gave her a few more things I want to take with me. "The belongings you need were sent off in trunks yesterday," she said, as she crossed the room towards my bed. "There were a few we forgot." She shook her head, reminding me there was precious little room in the carriage and that the journey to Dalbrook was a long one. "I'll manage," I answered. She carefully laid the cloak across my bed. It had been steamed and hung in the vault so no fold or wrinkle would tarnish its beauty. I ran my hand along the short velvet nap. The blue was as dark as midnight, and the rubies, tourmalines, and sapphires circling the edges were its stars. The jewels would prove useful. It was tradition that the cloak should be placed on the bride's shoulders by both her parents, and yet my mother had returned alone. I started to ask, but then I heard an army of footsteps echoing in the hallway. My heart sank lower than it already was. He wasn't coming alone, even for this. My father entered the chamber flanked by the Lord Vice Regent on one side, the Chancellor and the Royal Scholar on the other, and various minions of his cabinet parading on their heels. I knew the Vice Regent was only doing his job. He had pulled me aside shortly after the documents were signed and told me that he alone had argued against the marriage, but he was ultimately a rigid man of duty like the rest of them. I especially disliked the Scholar and Chancellor, as they were well aware, but I felt little guilt about it since I knew the feeling was mutual. My skin crawled whenever I neared them, as though I had just walked through a field of blood-sucking vermin. They, more than anyone, were probably glad to be rid of me. My father approached, kissed both of my cheeks, and stepped back to look at me, finally breathing a hearty sigh. "As beautiful as your mother on our wedding day." I wondered if the unusual display of emotion was for the benefit of those who looked on. I rarely saw a moment of affection pass between my mother and father. But then in a brief second I watched his eyes shift from me to her and linger there. My mother stared back at him, and I wondered what passed between them. Love, or regret at love lost and what might have been? The uncertainty alone filled a strange hollow within me, and 100 questions sprang to my lips. But with the Chancellor and Scholar and the impatient entourage looking on, I was reluctant to ask any of them. Maybe that was my father's intent. The timekeeper, a pudgy man with bulging eyes, pulled out his ever-present pocket watch. He and the others ushered my father around as if they were the ones who ruled the kingdom instead of the other way around. "We're pressed for time, Your Majesty," he reminded my father. The Vice Regent gave me a sympathetic glance but nodded agreement. "We don't want to keep the royal family of Dalbrook waiting on this momentous occasion. As you well know, Your Majesty, it wouldn't be well received." The spell and gaze were broken. My mother and father lifted the cloak and set it about my shoulders, securing the clasp at my neck, and then my father alone raised the hood over my head and again kissed each cheek, but this time with much more reserve, only fulfilling protocol. "You serve the kingdom of Morrigan well on this day, Arabella." Leah, he hated the name Jezaleah, because it had no precedent in the royal lineage, no precedent anywhere, he had argued, but my mother had insisted upon it without explanation. On this point, she had remained unyielding. It was probably the last time my father conceded anything to her wishes. I never would have known as much if not for Aunt Burnett. And even she treaded carefully around the subject, still a prickly thorn between my parents. I searched his face. The fleeting tenderness of just a moment past was gone, his thoughts already moving on to matters of state, but I held his gaze, hoping for more. There was nothing. I lifted my chin, standing taller. "Yes, I do serve the kingdom well, as I should, Your Majesty. I am, after all, a soldier in your army." He frowned and looked quizzically to my mother. Her head shook softly, silently dismissing the matter. My father, always the king first and father second, was satisfied with ignoring my remark, because, as always, other matters did press. He turned and walked away with his entourage, saying he'd meet me at the abbey, his duty to me now fulfilled. Duty, that was a word I hated as much as tradition. "Are you ready?" my mother asked, when the others had left the room. I nodded, but I have to attend to a personal need before we leave. I'll meet you in the lower hall. Please, mother, my voice broke for the first time. I just need a few minutes. My mother relented, and I listened to the lonely echo of her footsteps as she retreated down the hallway. Pauline, I whispered, swiping at my cheeks. Pauline entered my room through the dressing chamber. We stared at each other, no words necessary, clearly understanding what lay ahead of us, every detail of the day already wrestled with during a long, sleepless night. "There's still time to change your mind. Are you sure?" Pauline asked, giving me a last chance to back out. "Sure." My chest squeezed with pain, a pain so deep and real I wondered if hearts really were capable of breaking. Or was it fear that pierced me? I pressed my hand hard against my chest, trying to soothe the stab I felt there. Maybe this was the point of cleaving. "There's no turning back. The choice was made for me," I answered. "From this moment on, this is the destiny that I'll have to live with, for better or worse." "I pray the better, my friend," Pauline said, nodding her understanding. And with that, we hurried down the empty arched hallway toward the back of the citadel, and then down the dark servant's stairway. We passed no one. Everyone was either busy with preparations down at the abbey or waiting at the front of the citadel for the royal procession to the square. We emerged through a small wooden door with thick black hinges into blinding sunlight, the wind whipping in our dresses and throwing back my hood. I spotted the back fortress gate, only used for hunts and discreet departures, already open as ordered. Pauline led me across a muddy paddock to the shady hidden wall of the carriage house where a wide-eyed stable boy waited with two saddled horses. His eyes grew impossibly wider as I approached. "Your Highness, you're to take a carriage already prepared for you," he said, choking on his words as they tumbled out. "It's waiting by the steps at the front of the citadel. If you—" "The plans have changed," I said firmly, and I gathered my gown up in great bunches so I could get a foothold in the stirrup. The straw-haired boy's mouth fell open as he looked at my once pristine gown, the hem already sloshed with mud, now smearing my sleeves and lace bodice and worse, the morgue and jeweled wedding cloak. "But—" "Hurry, a hand up," I snapped, taking the reins from him. He obeyed, helping Pauline in similar fashion. "What shall I tell?" I didn't hear what else he said, the galloping hooves stampeding out all arguments past and present, with Pauline at my side in one swift act that could never be undone, an act that ended a thousand dreams but gave birth to one. I bolted for the cover of the forest and never looked back. And that ends the first chapter of The Kiss of Deception by Mary E. Pearson. If you enjoyed what you read, you can stop by the BHS library in person. We have two copies of this book. Or you can always check the book out on Sora through our local library. The music that we have used in this episode today is provided by Fez Lion Studios. And the views of the book are those of the participants and not the Benton Public School District. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again next week.